Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
All right, and finally today, let's turn to some sports, because even the best teams have a few clunkers in them, even the Pats. On Sunday, an emaciated Patriots roster fell to the lowly Philadelphia Eagles 35-28. There were some bright spots, though, like this breakout play by a new wide receiver.
And they snap it, and now here comes a double reverse, and they throw the ball to Brady. Across midfield, will step out of bounds.
In case you couldn't hear it, they throw the ball to Tom Brady, but it wasn't good enough. The Pats lost anyway. So here to talk about the week in sports is NPR's only game host, Bill Littlefield. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, Magna.
Okay, so first of all, let's just talk about that trick play. Does Tom Brady have a new career ahead of him as a wide receiver?
I think he probably does. And you may remember some years ago when the Pats were going through a bit of a tough stretch, and Giselle Bundchen, Tom Brady's wife, defended her husband by saying he can't catch the ball as well as throw the ball. And it turns out she was wrong. Certainly he can. And it's just a shame that he didn't do it, you know, in a winning effort.
Well, exactly. They lost anyway.
Yes, they did.
I mean, let's talk for a second about, you know, one of the reasons maybe why. So many people on the injured list, if those star players were back, including, you know, Gronkowski, you think they would have had the win?
Well, first of all, the injured list is part of football.
Yeah.
This is a game in which people get injured, and sometimes they get injured relatively not too seriously, and they come back after their sprained ankle or, you know, their hurting neck recovers. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they get injured much more seriously, and we may get to that a little later in the this segment. Obviously, if they'd been completely healthy, it would have been a different team, and the result might very well have been different. The Eagles have not been particularly impressive this season.
Okay. Well, actually, why don't we get right to what you were talking about, because the new film, Concussion, is coming out this month. You recently saw a preview of it. It's a movie about Dr. Bennett Omalu?
Omalu, yes.
Omalu. He's a pathologist who tried to talk to the NFL about the risk of traumatic brain injury in the early 2000s. You've seen the movie. How is it?
The movie is quite impressive, and one of the more interesting aspects of this movie is, of course, that lots of people who don't necessarily read medical journals and don't necessarily even read The New Yorker or the sports page will go to see a movie that Will Smith is starring in, and they will see an extraordinarily dramatic story played out within this film.
And in fact, I think they've been advertising it during major NFL games as well. But I see that Emily Kaplan from Sports Illustrated went to a screening of Concussion with 70 former NFL players in attendance.
Right.
What was their reaction?
Their reaction, as you might expect, varied. Some of the more dramatic reactions are extraordinary, and I would urge people to look at that article at SI.com that Emily wrote. One man sitting in the back of the theater hugging himself, saying, "I can't do this, I can't do this," was unable to sit through the film. Another man who left after the film and she interviewed him, he was sitting in the lobby with his head in his hands and tears pouring down his face. One fellow quoted as saying, "We were paid to give people concussions, but if I'd known that we were killing them, I'd never have put on the uniform." Wow. Now, of course, these are extraordinarily dramatic instances of responses to the film, but not entirely unrepresentative.
Do you think the film could do anything to further budge the NFL?
It's hard to say. The NFL is a gigantic and gigantically profitable corporation, and if they have managed so far as they have to basically head this thing off at the pass by throwing millions of dollars at it, I think probably they'll continue to be able to do that. I think the change is going to come when members of the public see this film in great numbers and lots of people say, gee, I'm not really sure it's such a good idea for my kid to play football. Dr. Amalu, by the way, had an editorial in the New York Times very recently saying exactly that, that it's not a good idea for children to be playing tackle football.
Yeah. Well, Bill, we have 45 seconds left, but I do want to get a little props out to the U.S. women's soccer team because they were supposed to play in Hawaii this past weekend, and they backed out. They decided not to. What happened?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what the sequence was with that, but they did not play because the field was deemed unplayable, and there were pictures on various websites, and that field certainly was unplayable. It was an artificial turf where the seams were actually separated. The bits of the field were separated from each other. It could have resulted in serious, even career-ending injury, and it's a disgrace that the women are asked to play on a field like that.
Yeah, and it's a problem that they had to face before, and this time they said, no, we won't. That's good that they stood up, but hopefully we can get fields in proper shape for them. Well, Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game. It airs on WBUR every Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., and he joins us on Wednesdays at Radio Boston. Bill, thanks.
Thank you.
Twenty years ago, Pixar produced the first ever computer-animated full-length feature film. It was about a collection of toys that came to life whenever they were left alone.
You actually think you're the Buzz Lightyear?
Oh, all this time I thought it was an act. Hey, guys, look! It's the real Buzz Lightyear!
You're mocking me, aren't you?
Oh, no, 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 no. Buzz, look, an alien!
Where?
The movie was, of course, Toy Story. And until that moment in history, it was Walt Disney who had defined film animation. Pictures drawn by hand, filmed in rapid succession to create movement. But then, computer technology brought a sea change to the art of animation. That's the focus of The Science Behind Pixar, an exhibit now running at the Museum of Science, which features bigger-than-life replicas of Buzz Lightyear and Sully, the big blue furry monster from Monsters, Inc. The exhibit lifts the curtain on how these characters are brought to life, from idea to modeling to the use of mathematical models that power the computer animation to create simulated water, light, hair, and movement.
I was completely blown away when I saw this. The way they've demonstrated the artwork, and the way they're able to demonstrate the various elements of the pipeline is just mind-boggling. This is one of the most spectacular exhibits that I've ever seen.
This is Ed Catmull, the co-founder of Pixar and the president of Walt Disney and Pixar Animation Studios. He was co-executive producer of Toy Story and is known as the father of computer animation. So let's listen back to a conversation Catmull had this summer with Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks at the Museum of Science exhibit. He told Anthony about his role in the computer animation revolution.
When I got out of graduate school, my goal was to make the first computer animated film. And I thought at the time that it would take about 10 years. I was wrong. It took 20 years.
But still, that's pretty quick progress.
Yeah, and we went through all these dramatic changes figuring stuff out so that by the time we got to 1991, we had enough technology that we believed we could do it. And so we entered into a relationship with Disney to make Toy Story, which came out in 1995. So this is now 20 years after that. And now, since then, the technologies continue to advance. And so a lot of this exhibit is about the things that were developed since then with additional advances in math and science. So it's understanding light. Like, most people aren't aware of this, but light goes through the outside of your nose and illuminates the inside. And if you had the flesh be opaque in a computer graphic, you could tell the difference. Now, these are subtle things. But our brain picks up all sorts of subtle things, that motions of the face. Right. So these are the physics of light and how light goes into the body and then back out again. And when you do that, your brain says, oh, this is right. But we never think about it.
I see.
So you have to figure that out.
So you have to think about how our brain processes things, not necessarily how we understand it.
Well, yeah, that's basically it. We've got the science at every level here. Yeah. There's how our brain interprets the world, and then how do we simulate that? How do we simulate the motion of water or the motion of hair? How do you give an animator the ability to control something which has got literally millions of things that can change.
It sounds impossible to figure out.
Well, it is pretty much impossible. But here's the thing. There are a lot of...
All you need is 20 years and a lot of brilliance.
Well, the thing is yeah. there are brilliant people in the field. Yeah. And if you do the math and the science right, and you get the perception right, you understand how we perceive, then it becomes seamless. And you're just engaged in this story, which is what we want. And I'd say for 20 years, the goal was to try to achieve reality. And then for us, it was to go beyond reality to make these fantasy worlds where they look real, but at the same time, there's something different and unusual about them.
So give me an example about this hyper-real world that you created.
So here in this exhibit, what we're showing is how do we figure out that we made the hair work for the movie Brave? That is, how do you actually create something that's controllable in the computer that generates all these kind of surfaces?
It's interesting that you mention hair because I remember being struck by Monsters, Inc. years ago, and the hair on the monsters was so real.
It flowed. If we walk over there, it was... It's like this had more hair than anything else ever had been done.
Right, and describe what we're looking at just for the listeners here.
So here's a 6-foot-tall model of Sully.
Well done.
And Sully's got some uncountable number of hairs. When he first started off with the computer graphics, it was absolutely inconceivable that you could even handle this amount of information. Since there are millions and millions of hairs,
right.
then you needed faster computers and bigger memories just to handle it.
Yeah.
But even then, it's so many that you couldn't handle it, so you have to generate them on the fly. Well, then how do you control it? So then we've got a smaller number of control hairs that move around and are blown around, and then the computer will generate the fill-in hairs. So you feel like it's real hair on a creature which is in the imagination of a child.
No! A kid! There's a kid here! A human kid!
So were there early efforts here where you sort of looked at the result and said, no, that's not it. We're not there. We're not at hair yet. I mean, it doesn't look like real hair yet.
Oh, yeah. We always start off that way. Yeah. In fact, all of our films are a disaster to begin with. And with every one of these films, they try to take on some technical challenge. And sometimes they're big and sometimes they're gigantic. We could have said, well, no hair. But you don't want to have everything be simple. So you always want a challenge, something that's going to be hard.
So this really is an intriguing question that I want to ask you in particular about. Why do you always want a challenge? Because Hollywood traditionally, well, especially now, it plays it so safe. And you were like trying to figure out how to do new stuff all the time, which is kind of chancy.
Well, I mean, there's a fundamental belief we have.
Yeah.
And that is that the way you make things cheaper and safer is to copy what you've done in the past.
Right.
We have no interest in copying ourselves. That's not advancing anything, either artistically or technically. So we push ourselves both artistically and technically, and we will take on movies that would not pass the elevator test.
And what does that mean?
Okay, the elevator test is where you should be so succinct with your idea that if you were to get in the elevator with an executive, by the time you got to the top floor, you could convince them that this was the right thing to do. And we take pride in the fact that with several of our films, we would not pass the elevator test. So if you think about Ratatouille as an example.
I brought you something to... No! Spit that out right now! I have got to teach you about food.
A rat that wants to cook. Where does that even go?
That's great.
Or you take the movie Up. So you've got an old man who floats away in a house with a stowaway boy. It doesn't matter how successful this film is, you're never going to sell a lot of toy walkers.
Right.
If all we did was take risk, we might actually become financially bankrupt.
Yeah.
So for us, it's like spread this risk out, but make sure you're always doing some things which are highly unlikely. So when we started Inside Out as an example, it was just a concept, is we're going to do something with the emotion inside of a girl's head. We had no idea how to embody that.
First day of school, very, very exciting. I was up late last night figuring out a new plan. Here it is, fear. I need a list of all the possible negative outcomes on the first day at a new school.
Way ahead of you there. Does anyone know how to spell meteor?
Disgust. Make sure Riley stands out today, but also blends in. When I'm through, Riley will look so good, the other kids will look at their own outfits and barf.
The initial couple years were just exploring what might that even be. And they had to work through that. And they tried a lot of things. It didn't work.
Yeah. How are ideas pitched in your world? In other words, is it a case of it just has to be a long, you know, a very tall building and a very long elevator ride? or you know, how are the pitches made?
Well, the first thing is that the idea of the film, the starting point, is not the relevant idea. It's what is the leadership, what's the team behind it, what's the passion. So we actually picked them first before we know what the movie is. We picked the director, and we say to the director, we want you to pitch three ideas. And then the following thing happens invariably. They'll come and they'll pitch these three ideas, and it's very clear that there's one of them which they're absolutely passionate about. That's the one we make. So it's driven by that passion. But it's just the beginning. The first versions don't work very well at all. They're disasters. So we have to judge them by the spirit of the team. Are they working well together? That's the only thing we've got to work with, is their passion.
What are you doing? Ah! Don't you know this is an exclusive club? Only explorers get in here. Not just any kid off the street with a helmet and a pair of goggles. Do you think you've got what it takes? Well, do you? All right, you're in. Welcome aboard.
I read, too, though, and I think you just touched on it, this idea of coming to terms and recognizing the early disasters. I've heard you describe yourself as a student of failure, and that being an important part about understanding what works.
Well, yes, and I believe this very strongly. There are two meanings of the word failure. All right, so there is one which we all understand, and that is we have all failed in our lives at various things, and they've helped contribute to us learning. And then there's another meaning of failure, and it's the one you learn initially in school, which is that if you fail a test or you fail a class, that it means you screwed up or you weren't smart, you know, or you didn't work hard. I mean, this is a very negative meaning. But even beyond school, only if I do something where I might fail do I grow. And the only way to avoid failure completely is to just replicate what you've done in the past. I don't find that very interesting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you must start down a path where it is highly likely that some of the stuff will not work out. So you must make it safe for somebody to go down a path, try it, and in the end find it doesn't work. And it's okay.
Ed, I want to thank you for that. I mean, I didn't come here to the Museum of Science expecting to sort of get a kind of unified connection between what Pixar has done and a meaning of life, but you've just provided it.
Well, here's the cool thing about this. Most of the world focuses just on the artwork because that's what they see.
Sure.
Without appreciating the tremendous passion of the scientists, and they take pride in the fact that that thing that they've worked on so hard actually is invisible to the people that see the movie. We still want to acknowledge, and that's what this incredible exhibit does, is it shows off and demonstrates not only the science and the art, but the passion of the art of the technical people behind it.
Just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, swimming, swimming. What do? We swim, swim.
Dorino singing.
Oh, 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 Dory. I love to swim in.
Dory.
When you want to swim, you want
see,
to
see, I'm going
to
get stuck now with that song. Now it's in my head.
Sorry.
Well, Ed, thank you. This has been fantastic.
Thank you.
That was Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks talking with Ed Catmull, president of Walt Disney and Pixar Animation Studios. The exhibit is called The Science Behind Pixar, and it's now on view at the Museum of Science in Boston. Well, that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.